had prepared for him this time. "We will need an extra soldier to complement our party," Vierna ordered.
"It can be arranged," Jarlaxle replied, beginning to catch on.
"But why? Will Dinan not be accompanying us?" Vierna's eyes flashed.
"He will," she said. "But my brother's role in the hunt has changed."
Jarlaxle didn't flinch, just continued to sit back and tap his fingers.
"Dinan did not believe in Loth's destiny," Vierna explained, casually taking a seat on the edge of Jarlaxle's desk. "He did not wish to accompany me in this critical mission. The Spider Queen has demanded this of us."
She hopped back to the floor, suddenly ferocious, and stepped back toward the opaque door. Jarlaxle made no move, except to flex the fingers on his dagger-throwing hand as Vierna's tirade continued. The priestess swept about the small room, praying to Loth, cursing those who would not fall to their knees before the goddess, and cursing her brothers Drizzt and Dinan. Then Vierna calmed again suddenly and smiled wickedly.
"Loth demands fealty," she said accusingly.
"Of course," replied the unshakable mercenary.
"Justice is for a priestess to deal."
"Of course." Vierna's eyes flashed. Jarlaxle quietly tensed, fearing that the unsteady female would lash out at him for some unknown reason. She instead went back to the door and called loudly for her brother. Jarlaxle saw the unremarkable, veiled silhouette beyond the portal, saw the opaque material bend and stretch as Dinan started in from the other side. A huge spider leg slipped into the room, then another, then a third. The mutated torso came through next, Dinan's unclothed and bloated body transmuted from the waist down into the lower torso of a giant black spider. His once fair face now seemed a dead thing, swollen and expressionless, his eyes showing no luster. The mercenary fought hard to keep his breathing steady. He removed his great hat and ran a hand over his bald, sweating head. The disfigured creature moved into the room fully and stood obediently behind Vierna, the priestess smiling at the mercenary's obvious discomfort.
"The quest is critical," Vierna explained. "Loth will not tolerate dissent."
If Jarlaxle had held any doubts about the Spider Queen's involvement with Vierna's quest, they were gone now. Vierna had exacted the ultimate punishment of drow society on troublesome Dinan, something only a high priestess in the highest favor of Loth could ever accomplish. She had replaced Dinan's graceful drow body with this grotesque and mutated arachnid form, had replaced Dinan's fierce independence with a malevolent demeanor that she could bend to her every whim. She had turned him into a drider. Part 2. Perceptions. There is no word in the drow language for love. The closest word I can think of is sinzerig, but that is a term better equated with physical lust or selfish greed. The concept of love exists in the hearts of some drow, of course, but true love, a selfless desire often requiring personal sacrifice, has no place in a world of such bitter and dangerous rivalries. The only sacrifices in drow culture are gifts to Loth, and those are surely not selfless, since the giver hopes, prays for something greater in return. Still, the concept of love was not new to me when I left the Underdark. I loved Zacnaphane. I loved both Belwar and Clacker. Indeed, it was the capacity, the need for love, that ultimately drove me from Menzo Berenzon. Is there in all the wide world a concept more fleeting, more elusive?
Many people of all the races seem simply not to understand love, burden its beauteous simplicity with preconceived notions and unrealistic expectations. How ironic that I, walking from the darkness of loveless Menzo Berenzon, can better grasp the concept than many of those who have lived with it, or at least with the very real possibility of it for all of their lives. Some things a renegade drow will not take for granted. My few journeys to Silvery Moon in these past 10 days have invited good-hearted jests from my friends. "Sure, and the elf has his eyes fixed on another wedding," Brunner has often crooned, regarding my relationship with Alustriel, the Lady of Silvery Moon. I accept the taunts in light of the sincere warmth and hopes behind them, and have not dashed those hopes by explaining to my dear friends that their notions are misguided. I appreciate Alustriel and the goodness she has shown me. I appreciate that she, a ruler in a too often unforgiving world, has taken such a chance as to allow a dark elf to walk freely down her city's wondrous avenues. Alustriel's acceptance of me as a friend has allowed me to draw my desires from my true wishes, not from expected limitations. But do I love her? No more than she loves me. I will admit, though, I do love the notion that I could love Alustriel, and she could love me, and that if the attraction were present, the color of my skin and the reputation of my heritage would not deter the noble lady of Silvery Moon. I know now, though, that love has become the most prominent part of my existence, that my bond of friendship with Brunner and Wulfgar and Regis is of utmost importance to any happiness that this drow will ever know. My bond with Catti Bree runs deeper still. Honest love is a selfless concept, that I have already said, and my own selflessness has been put to a severe test this spring. I fear now for the future, for Catti Bree and Wulfgar and the barriers they must together overcome. Wulfgar loves her, I do not doubt, but he burdens his love with a possessiveness that borders on disrespect. He should understand the spirit that is Catti Bree, should see clearly the fuel that stokes the fires in her marvelous blue eyes. It is that very spirit that Wulfgar loves, and yet he will undoubtedly smother it under the notions of a woman's place as her husband's possession. My barbarian friend has come far from his youthful days roaming the tundra. Farther still must he come to hold the heart of Brunner's fiery daughter, to hold Catti Bree's love. Is there in all the world a concept more fleeting, more elusive? Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 6. A Path Straight and Smooth.
"I'll not accept the group from Nesme," Brunner growled the barbarian emissary from Settlestone.
"But, King Dwarf,"
the large red-haired man stammered helplessly.
"No!"
Brunner's severe tone silenced him. "The archers of Nesme played a role in reclaiming Mithril Hall," Drizzt, who stood at Brunner's side in the audience hall, promptly reminded the dwarf king. Brunner shifted abruptly in his stone seat.
"Ye forgotten the treatment the Nesme dogs gave ye when first we passed through their land?"
he asked the drow. Drizzt shook his head, the notion actually bringing a smile to his face.
"Never," he replied. But his calm tones and expression revealed that, while he had not forgotten, he apparently had forgiven.
Looking at his ebon-skinned friend, so at peace and content, the huffy dwarf's rage was soon deflated.
"Ye think I should let them come to the wedding, then?"
"You're a king now," answered Drizzt, and he held out his hands as though that simple statement should explain everything. Brunner's expression showed clearly that it did not, though, and so the equally stubborn dark elf promptly elaborated. "Your responsibilities to your people lie in diplomacy," Drizzt explained. "Nesme will be a valuable trading partner and a worthwhile ally.
Besides, we can forgive the soldiers of an oft-imperiled town for their reaction to the sight of a dark elf.
Bah! You're too soft-hearted, elf! Brunner grumbled. And you're taking me along with ye!
He looked to the huge barbarian, obviously akin to Wulfgar, and nodded.
Send out me welcome to Nesme, then, but I'll be needing a count of them that's to attend.
The barbarian cast an appreciative look at Drizzt, then bowed and was gone, though his departure did little to stop Brunner's grumbling.
100 things to do, elf, the dwarf complained.
You try to make your daughter's wedding the grandest the land has ever seen, Drizzt remarked.
I try, Brunner agreed. She's deserving it, me Catty Bree. I've tried to give her what I could all these years, but...
Brunner held his hands out, inviting a visual inspection of his stout body, a pointed reminder that he and Catty Bree were not even of the same race. Drizzt put a hand on his friend's strong shoulder. No human could have given her more, he assured Brunner. The dwarf sniffled. Drizzt did well to hide his chuckle.
But 100 damn things, Brunner roared, his fit of sentimentality predictably short-lived. King's daughter has to get a proper wedding, I say. But I'm not forgetting much help in doing the damn thing right.
Drizzt knew the source of Brunner's overblown frustration. The dwarf had expected Regis, a former guildmaster and undeniably skilled in etiquette, to help in planning the huge celebration. Soon after Regis had arrived in the halls, Brunner had assured Drizzt that his troubles were over, that
Rumblebelly'll see to what's needin' seein' to.
In truth, Regis had taken on many tasks, but hadn't performed as well as Brunner had expected or demanded. Drizzt wasn't sure if this came from Regis's unexpected ineptitude or Brunner's doting attitude. A dwarf rushed in then and handed Brunner 20 different scrolls of possible layouts for the great dining hall. Another dwarf came in on the first one's heels, bearing an armful of potential menus for the feast. Brunner just sighed and looked helplessly to Drizzt.
You will get through this, the drow assured him.
And Catty Bree will think it the grandest celebration ever given. Drizzt meant to go on. But his last statement gave him pause, and a concerned expression crossed his brow that Brunner did not miss.
You're worried for the girl,
the observant dwarf remarked. More for Wulfgar, Drizzt admitted. Brunner chuckled.
I got 3 masons at work to fixing the lad's walls, he said. Something put a mighty anger in the boy.
Drizzt only nodded. He had not revealed to anyone that he had been Wulfgar's target on that particular occasion, that Wulfgar probably would have killed him blindly if the barbarian had won.
The boy's just nervous, Brunner said.
Again the drow nodded, though he wasn't certain he could bring himself to agree. Wulfgar was indeed nervous, but his behavior went beyond that excuse. Still, Drizzt had no better explanations, and since the incident in the room, Wulfgar had become friendly once more toward Drizzt, had seemed more his old self.
He'll settle down once the day gets past, Brunner went on,
and it seemed to Drizzt that the dwarf was trying to convince himself more than anyone else. This, too, Drizzt understood, for Catty Bree, the orphaned human, was Brunner's daughter in heart and soul. She was the one soft spot in Brunner's rock-hard heart, the vulnerable chink in the king's armor. Wulfgar's erratic, domineering behavior had not escaped the wise dwarf, it seemed. But while Wulfgar's attitude obviously bothered Brunner, Drizzt did not believe the dwarf would do anything about it, not unless Catty Bree asked him for help. And Drizzt knew that Catty Bree, as proud and stubborn as her father, would not ask, not from Brunner and not from Drizzt.
"Where ye been hiding, ye little trickster?"
Drizzt heard Brunner roar, and the dwarf's sheer volume startled Drizzt from his private contemplations. He looked over to see Regis entering the hall, the halfling looking thoroughly flustered.
"I ate my first meal of the day,"
Regis shouted back, and he got a sour look on his cherubic face and put a hand on his grumbling tummy.
No time for eating,
Brunner snapped back. We gotta...
100 things to do, Regis finished, imitating the dwarf's rough accent and holding up his chubby hand in a desperate plea for Brunner to back off.
Brunner stomped a heavy boot and stormed over to the pile of potential menus.
Since you're so set on thinking about food,
Brunner began as he gathered up the parchments and heaved them, showering Regis.
There'll be elves and humans aplenty at the feast, he explained as Regis scrambled to put the pile in order. Give them something their sensitive innards'll take.
Regis shot a pleading look at Drizzt, but when the drow only shrugged in reply, the halfling picked up the parchments and shuffled away.
I'd have thought that one'd be better at this wedding planning stuff, Brunner remarked, loudly enough for the departing halfling to hear.
And not so good at fighting goblins, Drizzt replied, remembering the halfling's remarkable efforts in the battle. Brunner stroked his thick red beard and looked to the empty doorway through which Regis had just passed.
Spent lots of time on the road beside the likes of us, the dwarf decided.
Too much time, Drizzt added under his breath, too quietly for Brunner to hear, for it was obvious to the drow that Brunner, unlike Drizzt, thought the surprising revelations about their halfling friend a good thing. A short while later, when Drizzt, on an errand for Brunner, neared the entrance to Cobble's Chapel, he found that Brunner was not the only one flustered by the hectic preparations for the upcoming wedding.
Not for all the mithril in Brunner's realm, he heard
Catibri emphatically shout.
Be reasonable,
Cobble winked back at her.
Your father's not asking too much.
Drizzt entered the chapel to see Catibri standing atop a pedestal, hands resolutely on her slender hips, and Cobble down low before her, holding out a gem-studded apron. Catibri regarded Drizzt and gave a curt shake of her head.
They're wanting me to wear a smithy's apron, she cried. A damned smithy's apron on the day of me wedding!
Drizzt prudently realized that this was not the time to smile. He walked solemnly to Cobble and took the apron.
Battlehammer tradition, the cleric huffed.
Any dwarf would be proud to wear the raiment, Drizzt agreed. Must I remind you, though, that Catibri is no dwarf?
A symbol of subservience is what it is,
the auburn-haired woman spouted.
Dwarven females are expected to labor at the forge all the day. Not ever have I lifted a smithy's hammer and...
Drizzt calmed her with an outstretched hand and a plaintive look.
She's Brunner's daughter, Cobble pointed out. She has a duty to please her father.
Indeed, Drizzt, the consummate diplomat, agreed once more. But remember that she is not marrying a dwarf. Catibri has never worked the forge.
It's symbolic,
Cobble protested. And Wulfgar lifted the hammer only during his years of servitude to Brunner, when he was given no choice. Drizzt finished without missing a beat. Cobble looked to Catibri, then back to the apron, and sighed.
We'll find a compromise, he conceded.
Drizzt threw a wink Catibri's way, and was surprised to realize that his efforts apparently had not brightened the young woman's mood.
I have come from Brunner, the drow ranger said to Cobble. He mentioned something about testing the holy water for the ceremony.
Tasting,
Cobble corrected, and he hopped all about, looking this way and that.
Yes, yes, the mead, he said, obviously flustered. Brunner's wanting to settle the mead issue this day,
he looked up at Drizzt.
We're thinking that the dark stuff'll be too much for the soft-bellied group from Silvery Moon.
Cobble rushed about the large chapel, scooping buckets from the various fonts that lined the walls. Catibri offered Drizzt an incredulous shrug as he silently mouthed the words, Holy water? Priests of most religions prepared their blessed water with exotic oils. It should have come as no surprise to Drizzt, after many years beside Rowdy Brunner, that the dwarven clerics used hops. Brunner said you should bring a generous amount, Driz said to Cobble, instructions that were hardly necessary given that the excited cleric already had filled a small cart with flasks.
"We're done for the day,"
Cobble announced to Catty Bree. The dwarf ambled quickly to the door, his precious cargo bouncing along.
"But don't ye be thinking that ye've had the last word in all of this,"
Catty Bree snarled again. But Cobble, rambling along at top speed, was too far gone to notice. Drizzt and Catty Bree sat side by side on the small pedestal, in silence for some time. "Is the apron so bad?" the drow finally mustered the nerve to ask. Catty Bree shook her head.
"'Tis not the garment, but the meaning of the thing I'm not liking," she explained. "Me wedding's in 2 10 days. I'm thinking that I've seen me last adventure, me last fight, except for those I'm doomed to face against me own husband."
The blunt admission struck Drizzt profoundly and alleviated much of the weight of keeping his fears private. "Goblins across Faerun will be glad to hear that," he said facetiously, trying to bring some levity to the young woman's dark mood. Catty Bree did manage a slight smile, but there remained a profound sadness in her blue eyes. "You fought as well as any," Drizzt added.
"Did ye think not that I would?"
Catty Bree snapped at him, suddenly defensive, her tone as sharp as the edges of Drizzt's magical scimitars.
"Are you always so filled with anger?" Drizzt retorted, and his accusing words calmed Catty Bree immediately.
"Just scared, I'm guessing,"
she replied quietly. Drizzt nodded, understanding and appreciating his friend's growing dilemma.
"I must go back to Brunner," he explained, rising from the pedestal.
He would have left it at that, but he could not ignore the pleading look Catty Bree then gave him. She turned away immediately, staring straight ahead under the cowl of her thick auburn locks, and that despondence struck Drizzt even more profoundly.
"It is not my place to tell you how you should feel," Drizzt said evenly. Still, the young woman did not look back at him. "My burden as your friend is equal to the one you carried in the southern city of Kalimport when I had lost my way. I say to you now, the path before you turns soon in many directions, but that path is yours to choose. For all our sakes, and mostly yours, I pray that you consider your course carefully." He bent low, pushed back the side of Catty Bree's hair, and kissed her gently on the cheek. He did not look back as he left the chapel.
Half of Cobble's cart was already empty by the time the drow entered Brunner's audience hall. Brunner, Cobble, Dagna, Wulfgar, Regis, and several other dwarves argued loudly over which pail of the holy water held the finest, smoothest taste, arguments that inevitably produced further taste tests, which in turn created further arguments.
"This one!"
Brunner bellowed after draining a pail and coming back up with his red beard covered in foam.
"That one's good for goblins," Wulfgar roared, his voice dull.
His laughter ended abruptly, though, when Brunner plopped the pail over his head and gave it a resounding backhand.
"I could be wrong,"
Wulfgar, suddenly sitting on the floor, admitted, his voice echoing under the metal bucket.
"Tell me what ye think, drow,"
Brunner bellowed when he noticed Drizzt. He held out 2 sloshing buckets. Drizzt put up a hand, declining the invitation.
"Mountain springs are more to my liking than thick mead," he explained.
Brunner threw the buckets at him, but the drow easily stepped aside, and the dark golden liquid oozed slowly across the stone floor. The sheer volume of the ensuing protests from the other dwarves at the waste of good mead astounded Drizzt, but not as much as the fact that this probably was the first time he had ever seen Brunner scolded without finding the courage to fight back.
"Me king!"
came a call from the door, ending the argument. A rather plump dwarf, fully arrayed in battle gear, entered the audience hall, the seriousness of his expression deflating the mirth in the tasting chamber.
Seven kin have not returned from the newer sections, the dwarf complained. Taking their time is all, Brunner replied. They missed their supper, said the guard. Trouble, Cobble and Dagna said together, suddenly solemn. Baa, snorted Brunner as he waved his thick hand unsteadily in front of him. There be no more goblins in them tunnels. The groups down there now are just hunting mithril. They've found a vein of the stuff, I tell ye. That'll keep any dwarf even from his supper.
Cobble and Dagna, even Regis, Drizzt noted, wagged their heads in agreement. Given the potential danger whenever traveling the tunnels of the Underdark, and the deepest tunnels of Mithril Hall could be considered nothing less, the wary drow was not so easily convinced.
What are ye thinking?
Brunner asked Drizzt, seeing his plain concern. Drizzt considered his response for a long while. I am thinking that you are probably right.
Probably?
Brunner huffed.
Ah, well, I never could convince ye. Go, then, if it's what ye want. Take your cat and go find me overdue dwarves.
Drizzt's wry smile left no doubt that Brunner's instructions had been his intention all along.
I am Wulfgar, son of Beornagar. I will go, Wulfgar proclaimed.
But he sounded somewhat ridiculous with his head still under the bucket. Brunner leveled another backhand to silence his spouting.
And elf,
the king called, turning Drizzt back to him. Brunner offered a wicked smile to all of those about him, then dropped it fully over Regis.
Be taking Rumblebelly with ye, the dwarf king explained. He's not doing me much good about here.
Regis's big round eyes got even bigger and rounder. He ran plump, soft fingers through his curly brown hair, then tugged uncomfortably at the one dangling earring he wore.
Me? He asked meekly. Go back down there?
He went once, Brunner reasoned, making his argument more to the other dwarves than to Regis. Got yourself a few goblins, if me memory's right.
I have too much to—
Get ye going, Rumblebelly,
Brunner growled, leaning forward in his seat and nearly overbalancing in the process.
For the first time since ye come running back to us, and know that we're knowing you're running. Do what I ask of ye, without your back talk and excuses.
The seriousness of Brunner's grim tone surprised everyone in the room, apparently even Regis, for the halfling offered not another word, just got up and walked obediently to stand beside Drizzt.
Can we stop by my room?
Regis quietly asked the drow.
I would like my mace and pack at least.
Drizzt draped an arm over his 3-foot-tall companion's slumping shoulders and turned him about. Fear not, he said under his breath. And to accentuate the point, he dropped the onyx figurine of Guinevere into the halfling's eager hands. Regis knew he was in fine company. Chapter 7. Quiet in the Darkness. Even with burning lamps lining all the walls, and the paths clear and well-marked, it took Drizzt and Regis the better part of 3 hours to cross the miles of the great Mithril Hall complex to the new tunnel areas. They passed through the wondrous, tiered undercity, with its many levels of dwarven dwellings that resembled gigantic steps on 2 sides of the huge cavern. The dwellings overlooked a central work area on the cavern floor that bustled with the activities of the industrious race. This was the hub of the entire complex. Here the majority of Brunner's people lived and worked. Great furnaces roared all day, every day. Dwarven hammers rang out in a continual song, and though the mines had been opened for only a couple of months, thousands of finished products, everything from finely crafted weapons to beautiful goblets, already filled many pushcarts, which waited along the walls for the onset of the trading season. Drizzt and Regis entered from the eastern end on the top tier, crossed the cavern along a high bridge, and weaved down the many stairways to exit the city's lowest level, heading west into Mithril Hall's deepest mines.
Low-burning lamps lined the walls, though these were fewer now and farther between, and every now and then the companions came to a dwarven work crew bleeding precious silvery mithril from the tunnel wall. Then they came to the outer tunnels, where there were no lamps and no dwarves. Drizzt pulled off his pack, thinking to light a torch, but noticed the halfling's eyes glowing with the telltale red of infravision.
"I do prefer the light of a torch,"
Regis commented when the drow started to replace the pack without striking a light.
"We should save them," Drizzt answered. "We do not know how long we will have to remain in the new areas,"
Regis shrugged. Drizzt took amusement in the fact that the halfling was already holding his small but undeniably effective mace, though they hadn't yet passed beyond the secured regions of the complex. They took a short break, then started on again, putting another 2 or 3 miles behind them. Predictably, Regis soon began to complain about his sore feet, and quieted only when they heard the sound of dwarven chatter somewhere up ahead. A few twists and turns in the tunnel took them to a narrow stair that emptied into the final guardroom of this section. 4 dwarves were in there, playing bones, grumbling with every throw, and paying little attention to the great iron-barred stone door that sealed off the new areas.
"Well met," Drizzt said, interrupting the game.
"We got some kin down there,"
a stocky, brown-bearded dwarf replied as soon as he noticed Drizzt.
"King Brunner sending yourselves to find them?"
"Lucky us,"
Regis remarked.
Drizzt nodded. "We are to remind the missing dwarves that the mithril will be gotten in proper time," he said,
trying to keep this encounter light-hearted, wanting to not alarm the dwarven guards by telling them that he believed there might be trouble in the new section. 2 of the dwarves took up their weapons while the other 2 walked over to remove the heavy iron bar that locked the door.
"Well, when you're ready to come back out, tap the door 3, then 2.
The brown-bearded dwarf explained.
"We're not for opening it unless the signal's right."
3, then 2, Drizzt agreed. The bar came off, and the door fell inward with a great sucking sound. Nothing but the blackness of an empty tunnel was apparent beyond it.
"Easy, my little friend," Drizzt said, seeing the sudden gleam in the halfling's eye.
They had been down here just a couple of 10 days before for the goblin fight. But though they had seen that threat eradicated, the hushed tunnel seemed no less imposing.
"Hurry ye up,"
the brown-bearded dwarf said to them, obviously not happy with keeping the door open. Drizzt lighted a torch and led the way into the gloom, Regis close on his heels. The dwarves shut the door immediately when the companions were clear, and Drizzt and Regis heard the clanging of the iron bar being set back into place. Drizzt handed Regis the torch and drew out his scimitars, twinkle glowing a soft blue.
"We should get done as quickly as we can," the drow reasoned. "Bring in Guinevar and let the cat lead us."
Regis set down his mace and torch and fumbled around to find the onyx figurine. He placed it on the ground before him and took up his other items, then looked to Drizzt, who had moved a few steps farther down the tunnel.
"You may call the panther,"
Drizzt said, somewhat surprised when he looked back to see the halfling waiting for him, a curious sight given Regis's close relationship with the great cat. Guinevar was a magical entity, a denizen of the astral plane, that came to the summons of the figurine's possessor. Brunner always had been a bit shy around the cat. Dwarves didn't generally like magic other than the magic of fine weapons, but Regis and Guinevar had been close friends. Guinevar had even saved the halfling's life once by taking Regis along on an astral ride, getting the halfling out of a collapsing tower in the process. Now, though, Regis stood above the figurine, torch and mace in hand, apparently unsure of how to proceed. Drizzt walked back the few steps to join his diminutive friend.
"What is the problem?" he asked.
I just think you should call Guinevar,"
the halfling replied.
"It's your panther, after all, and yours is the voice Guinevar knows best."
"Guinevar would come to your call," Drizzt assured Regis, patting the halfling's shoulder.
Not wanting to delay and argue the point, though, the drow softly called out the panther's name. A few seconds later, a grayish mist, seeming darker in the dim light, gathered about the figurine and gradually shaped itself into the panther form. The mist subtly transformed, became something more substantial. Then it was gone, leaving in its stead Guinevere's muscled feline form. The panther's ears went flat immediately. Regis took a prudent step back. Then Drizzt grabbed Guinevere by a jowl and gave a playful shake. "Some dwarves are missing," Drizzt explained to the cat, and Regis knew that Guinevere understood every word. "Find their scent, my friend. Lead me to them." Guinevere spent a long moment studying the immediate area, turned back to stare at Regis for a bit, then issued a low growl. "Go on," Drizzt bade the cat, and the sleek muscles flexed, propelling Guinevere easily and in perfect silence into the darkness beyond the torchlight. Drizzt and Regis followed at an easy pace, the drow confident that the panther would not outdistance them, and Regis glancing nervously this way and that with every passing inch. They came through the intersection with the giant Etin's bones, Brunner's first kill, a short while later, and Guinevere joined them once more when they entered the low cavern where the main goblin force had been routed. Little evidence remained of that recent battle, save the many bloodstains and a diminishing pile of goblin bodies in the center of the place. 10-foot-long, worm-like creatures swarmed all about these, long tendrils feeling the way as they feasted on the bloated corpses. "Keep close," Drizzt warned, and Regis didn't have to be told twice. "Those are carrion crawlers," the drow ranger explained, "the vultures of the Underdark. With food so readily available, they likely will leave us alone, but they are dangerous foes. A sting from their tendrils can steal the strength from your limbs."
"Do you think the dwarves got too close to them?"
Regis asked, squinting in the dim light to see if he could make out any non-goblin bodies among the pile. Drizzt shook his head. "The dwarves know the crawlers well," he explained. "They welcome the beasts to be rid of the stench of goblin corpses. I would hardly expect 7 veteran dwarves to be taken down by crawlers." Drizzt started down from the angled platform, but the halfling grabbed his cloak to stop him.
"There's a dead Etin under here," Regis explained. "Lots of meat."
Drizzt cocked his head curiously as he regarded the quick-thinking halfling, the drow thinking that maybe Brunner had been wise in sending the little one along. They skirted the lip of the raised stone and came down far to the side. Sure enough, several carrion crawlers worked over the huge Etin body. Drizzt's original course would have taken him dangerously close to the beasts. They were into the empty tunnels again in a few seconds, Guinevere drifting silently into the darkness to lead them. The torch soon burned low. Regis shook his head when Drizzt reached for another one, reminding Drizzt that they should save their light sources. They went on in the quiet, in the dark, with only the soft glow of twinkle to mark their passing. To the drow it seemed like old times, traversing the Underdark with his feline companion, his senses heightened in the knowledge that danger might well lurk around any bend. "The disk is warm?" Jarlaxle asked, seeing Vierna's pleasurable expression as she rubbed her delicate fingers across the metallic surface. She sat atop the drider, her mount for the journey, Dinan's bloated face expressionless and unblinking.
"My brother is not far," the priestess replied, her eyes closed in concentration.
The mercenary leaned against the wall, peering down the long tunnel filled with flattened goblin corpses. All about him, dark forms, his quiet band of killers, slipped silently about their way.
"Can we know that Drizzt is here at all?" the mercenary dared to ask, though he was not anxious to dispel volatile Vierna's anticipation, especially not with the priestess sitting atop so poignant a reminder of her wrath.
"He is here," Vierna replied calmly.
"Then you are sure our friend will not kill him before we find him?" the mercenary asked.
"We can trust this ally,"
Vierna replied calmly, her tone a relief to the edgy mercenary leader.
"Lolf has assured me."
So ends any debate, Jarlaxle told himself, though he hardly felt secure in trusting any human, particularly the wicked one to whom Vierna had led him. He looked back to the tunnel, back to the shifting forms, as the mercenary band cautiously made its way. What Jarlaxle did trust was his soldiers, drow for drow as fine a force as any in the dark elf world. If Drisdo Erden was indeed wandering about these tunnels, the skilled killers of Brakendy Earth would get him.
"Should I dispatch the Baenri force?" the mercenary asked Vierna.
Vierna considered the words for a moment, then shook her head, her indecision revealing to Jarlaxle that she was not as certain of her brother's whereabouts as she claimed.
"Keep them close a while longer," she instructed. "When we have found my brother, they will serve to cover our departure."
Jarlaxle was all too glad to comply. Even if Drizzt was down here, as Vierna believed, they did not know how many of his friends might have accompanied him. With 50 drow soldiers about them, the mercenary was not too worried. He did wonder, though, how Triel Baenri might welcome the news that her soldiers, even if they were only males, had been used as no more than fodder.
"These tunnels are endless,"
Regis moaned, after 2 more hours of unremarkable twists and turns in the goblin-enhanced natural passageways. Drizzt allowed a break for supper, even lit a torch, and the two friends sat in a small natural chamber on a flat rock, surrounded by leering stalactites and monster-like mounds of piled stone. Drizzt understood just how unintentionally perceptive the halfling's words might prove. They were far underground, several miles, and the caverns continued aimlessly, connecting chambers large and small and meeting with dozens of side passages. Regis had been in the dwarven mines before, but he had never entered that next lower realm, the dreaded Underdark, wherein lived the drow elves, wherein Drizdo Erden had been born. The stifling air and inevitable realizations of thousands of tons of rock over his head inevitably led the dark elf to thoughts of his past life, of the days when he had lived in Menzo Berenzon, or walked with Gwenevar in the seemingly endless tunnels of Toril's subterranean world.
"We'll get lost, just like the dwarves,"
Regis grumbled, munching a biscuit. He took tiny bites and chewed them 1,000 times to savor each precious crumb. Drizzt's smile didn't seem to comfort him, but the ranger was confident that he and, more particularly, Gwenevar knew exactly where they were, making a systematic circuit with the chamber of the main goblin battle as their hub. He pointed behind Regis, his motion prompting the halfling to half-turn in his rocky seat. "If we went back through that tunnel and branched at the first right-hand passage, we would come in a matter of minutes to the large chamber where Brunner defeated the goblins," Drizzt explained. "We were not so far from this spot when we met Cobble."
"Seems like farther, that's all,"
Regis mumbled under his breath. Drizzt did not press the point, glad to have Regis along, even if the halfling was in a particularly grumpy mood. Drizzt hadn't seen much of Regis in the 10 days since he had returned to Mithril Hall. No one had, actually, except perhaps the dwarven cooking staff in the communal dining halls.
"Why have you returned?"
Drizzt asked suddenly, his question making Regis choke on a piece of biscuit. The halfling stared at him incredulously.
"We are glad to have you back," Drizzt continued, clarifying the intentions of his rather blunt question. "And certainly, all of us are hoping you will stay here for a long time to come. But why, my friend?"
"The wedding,"
Regis stammered. "A fine reason, but hardly the only one," Drizzt replied with a knowing smile.
"When last we saw you, you were a guildmaster, and all of Kalimport was yours for the taking."
Regis looked away, ran his fingers through his curly brown hair, fiddled with several rings, and slipped his hand down to tug at his one dangling earring.
"That is the life the Regis I know always desired," Drizzt remarked.
"Then maybe you really didn't understand Regis,"
the halfling replied.
"Perhaps," Drizzt admitted. "But there is more to it than that. I know you well enough to understand that you would go to great lengths to avoid a fight. Yet when the goblin battle came, you remained beside me."
"Where safer than with Drizzt O'Erden?"
"In the higher complex, in the dining halls," the drow replied without hesitation. Drizzt's smile was one of friendship. The luster in his lavender eyes showed no animosity for the halfling, whatever falsehoods Regis might be playing.
"Whatever the reason you have come, be sure that we are all glad you are here," Drizzt said honestly.
"Brunner more than any, perhaps. But if you have found some trouble, some danger, you would be well advised to state it openly that we might battle it together. We are your friends and will stand beside you, without blame, against whatever odds we are offered. By my experience, those odds are always better when I know the enemy."
"I lost the guild," Regis admitted. "Just 2 10-days after you left Kalimport."
The news did not surprise the drow.
"Artemis and Treri,"
Regis said grimly, lifting his cherubic face to stare at Drizzt directly, studying the drow's every movement.
"And Treri took the guild?" Drizzt asked.
Regis nodded.
"He didn't have such a hard time of that. His network reached to my most trusted colleagues."
"You should have expected as much from the assassin," Drizzt replied, and he gave a small laugh which made Regis's eyes widen with apparent surprise.
"You find this funny?"
"The guild is better in Entreri's hands," Drizzt replied, to the halfling's continued surprise. "He is suited for the double-dealing ways of miserable Kalimport."
"I thought you—" Regis began. "I mean, don't you want to go and—"
"Kill Entreri?" Drizzt asked with a soft chuckle. "My battle with the assassin has ended," he added, when Regis's eager nod confirmed his guess.
"And Treri might not think so,"
Regis said grimly. Drizzt shrugged and noticed that his casual attitude seemed to bother the halfling more than a little.
"As long as Entreri remains in the Southland, he is of no concern to me."
Drizzt knew that Regis didn't expect Entreri to remain in the South. Perhaps that was why Regis would not stay in the upper levels during the goblin fight, Drizzt thought. Perhaps Regis feared that Entreri might sneak into Mithril Hall. If the assassin found both Drizzt and Regis, he probably would go after Drizzt first.
"You hurt him, you know," Regis went on. "In your fight, I mean. He's not the type to forgive something like that."
Drizzt's look became suddenly grave. Regis shifted back, putting more distance between himself and the fires in the drow's lavender eyes.
"Do you believe he has followed you north?"
Drizzt asked bluntly. Regis shook his head emphatically.
"I arranged things so it would look like I had been killed," he explained. "Besides, Entreri knows where Mithril Hall is. He could find you without having to follow me here." "But he won't," Regis went on. "From all I have heard, he has lost the use of one arm, and lost an eye as well. He would hardly be your fighting equal anymore."
"It was the loss of his heart that stole his fighting ability," Drizzt remarked, more to himself than to Regis.
Despite his casual attitude, Drizzt could not easily dismiss his long-standing rivalry with the deadly assassin. Entreri was his opposite in many ways, passionless and amoral, but in fighting ability he had proven to be Drizzt's equal, almost. Entreri's philosophy maintained that a true warrior be a heartless thing, a pure, efficient killer.
Drizzt's beliefs went in exactly the opposite direction. To the drow, who had grown up among so many warriors holding similar ideals as the assassin, the passion of righteousness enhanced a warrior's prowess.
Drizzt's father, Zacnaphane, was unequaled in Menzo Baranzon, because his swords rang out for justice, because he fought with a sincere belief that his battles were morally justified.
"Do not doubt that he will ever hate you,"
Regis remarked grimly, stealing Drizzt's private contemplations. Drizzt noted a sparkle in the halfling's eye and took it as an indication of Regis's burning hatred of Entreri. Did Regis expect him to go back to Kalimport and finish his war with Entreri, the drow wondered? Did Regis expect Drizzt to deliver the Thieves' Guild back to him, deposing its assassin leader?
"He hates me because my way of life shows his to be an empty lie," Drizzt remarked firmly, somewhat coldly.
The drow would not go back to Kalimport, would not go back to do battle with Artemis Entreri for any reason. To do so would put him on the assassin's moral level, something the drow, who had turned his back on his own amoral people, feared more than anything in all the world. Regis looked away, apparently catching on to Drizzt's true feelings. Disappointment was obvious in his expression. The drow had to believe that Regis really did hope he would regain his precious guild at the end of Drizzt's scimitars. And Drizzt didn't really take much hope in the halfling's claims that Entreri would not come north. If the assassin, or at least agents of the assassin, would not be about, then why had Regis remained tight to Drizzt's side when they went down to fight the goblins? "Come," the drow bade, before his mounting anger could take hold of him. "We have many more miles to cover before we break for the night. We must soon send Guinevar back to the astral plane, and our chances of finding the dwarves are better with a panther beside us." Regis stuffed his remaining food in his small pack, doused the torch, and fell in step behind the drow. Drizzt looked back at him often, somewhat amazed, somewhat disappointed, by the angry glow in the red dots that were the halfling's eyes.
Chapter 8. Sparks of Flying. Beads of glistening sweat rolled along the barbarian's sculpted arms. Shadows of the flickering hearth drew definitive lines along his biceps and thick forearms, accentuating the enormous corded muscles. With astounding ease, as though he were swinging a tool made for slender nails, Wulfgar brought a 20-pound sledge down repeatedly on a metal shaft. Bits of molten iron flew with every ringing hit and spattered the walls and floor and the thick leather apron he wore, for the barbarian had carelessly overheated the metal. Blood surged in Wulfgar's great shoulders, but he did not blink and he did not tire. He was driven by the certainty that he had to work out the demon emotions that had grabbed his heart. He would find solace in exhaustion. Wulfgar had not worked the forge in years, not since Brunner had released him from servitude back in Icewind Dale, a place, a life that seemed a million miles removed. Wulfgar needed the iron now, needed the unthinking, instinctual pounding, the physical duress to overrule the confusing jumble of emotions that would not let him rest. The rhythmic banging forced his thoughts into a straight-line pattern. He allowed himself to consider only a single complete thought between each interrupting bang. He wanted to resolve so many things this day, mostly to remind himself of those qualities that initially had drawn him to his soon-to-be bride. At each interval, though, the same image flashed to him, Aegis Fang twirling dangerously close to Drizzt's head. He had tried to kill his dearest friend. With suddenly renewed vigor, he sent the sledge pounding home on the metal and again sent lines of sparks flying throughout the small private chamber. What in the nine hells was happening to him? Again the sparks flew wildly. How many times had Drizzt O'Erden saved him? How empty would his life have been without his ebon-skinned friend? He grunted as the hammer hit home. But the drow had kissed Catti Bree, Wulfgar's Catti Bree, outside Mithril Hall on the day of his return. Wulfgar's breathing came in labored gasps, but his arm pumped fiercely, playing his fury through the smithy hammer. His eyes were closed as tightly as the hand that clenched the hammer, his muscles swelled with the strain.
That one for throwing around corners? He heard a dwarf's voice ask.
Wolfgar's eyes popped open, and he spun about to see one of Brunner's kinfolk shuffling past the partly open doorway, the dwarf's laughter echoing as he made his way along the stone-worked corridor. When the barbarian looked back to his work, he understood the dwarf's mirth, for the metal spear he had been shaping was now badly bowed in the middle from the two hard slams on the overheated metal. Wolfgar tossed the ruined shaft aside and let the hammer drop to the stone floor.
"Why did you do it to me?" he asked aloud,
though of course Drizzt was too far away to hear him. His mind held a conjured image of Drizzt and his beloved Catti Bree embraced in a deep kiss, an image that beleaguered Wolfgar could not let go, even though he had not actually seen the two in the act. He wiped a hand across his sweaty brow, leaving a line of soot on his forehead, and slumped to a seat on the edge of a stone table. He hadn't expected things to become this complicated, hadn't anticipated Catti Bree's outrageous behavior. He thought of the first time he had seen his love, when she was barely more than a girl, skipping along the tunnels of the dwarven complex in Icewind Dale, carelessly skipping, as though all the ever-present dangers of that harsh region and all the memories of the recent war against Wolfgar's people simply fell away from her delicate shoulders, bounced off her as surely as did her lustrous auburn tresses. It didn't take young Wolfgar long to understand that Catti Bree had captured his heart with that carefree dance. He had never met a woman like her. In his male-dominated tribe, women were virtual slaves, cowering to the often unreasonable demands of the menfolk. Barbarian women did not dare to question their men, certainly did not embarrass them, as Catti Bree had done to Wolfgar when he had insisted that she not accompany the force sent to parley with the goblin tribe. Wolfgar was wise enough now to admit his own shortcomings, and he felt a fool for the way he had spoken to Catti Bree. Still, there remained in the barbarian a need for a woman, a wife that he could protect, a wife that would allow him his rightful place as a man. Things had become so very complicated, and then, just to make matters worse, Catti Bree, his Catti Bree, had shared a kiss with Drizzt O'Erden. Wolfgar bounced up from his seat and rushed to retrieve the hammer, knowing that he would spend many more hours at the forge, many more hours transferring the rage from his knotted muscles to the metal. For the metal had yielded to him as Catti Bree would not, had complied to the undeniable call of his heavy hammer. Wolfgar sent the hammer down with all his might, and a newly heated metal bar shuddered with the impact. Pong! Sparks whipped across Wolfgar's high cheekbones, one nipping at the edge of his eye. Blood surging, muscles corded, Wolfgar felt no pain.
"Put up the torch," the drow whispered.
"Light will alert our enemies,"
Regis argued in similarly hushed tones. They heard a growl, low and echoing down the corridor.
"The torch,"
Drizzt instructed, handing Regis a small tinderbox.
"Wait here with the light. Guinevere and I will circle about."
"Now I am bait?"
the halfling asked. Drizzt, his senses tuned outward for signs of danger, did not hear the question. One scimitar drawn, twinkle and its telltale glow waiting poised in its sheath, he slipped silently ahead and disappeared into the gloom. Regis, still grumbling, struck flint to steel and soon had the torch blazing. Drizzt was out of sight. A growl spun the halfling about, mace at the ready, but it was only Guinevere, ever alert, doubling back down a side passage. The panther padded past the halfling, following Drizzt's course, and Regis quickly shuffled behind, though he could not hope to keep pace with the beast. He was alone again in seconds, his torch casting elongated, ominous shadows along the uneven walls. His back to the stone, Regis inched on, as quiet as death.
The black mouth of a side passage loomed just a few feet away. The halfling continued walking, holding the torch straight out behind him, his mace leading the way. He sensed a presence around that corner, something inching up to the edge at him from the other direction. Regis carefully laid the torch on the stone and brought his mace in close to his chest, gently sliding his feet to perfectly balance his weight. He went around the corner in a blinding rush, chopping with a mace. Something blue flashed to intercept. There came the ring of metal on metal. Regis instantly brought his weapon back and sent it whipping in sidelong, lower. Again came the distinctive ring of a parry. Out came the mace and back in, deftly along the same course. The halfling's skilled adversary was not fooled, though, and the blocking blade was still in place.
Regis!
The mace twirled above the halfling's head, ready to dart again, but Regis swung it down at arm's length instead, suddenly recognizing the voice.
I told you to remain back there with the light, Drizzt scolded him, stepping out of the shadow. You are fortunate I did not kill you.
Or that I did not kill you,
Regis replied without missing a beat, and his calm, cold tone made Drizzt's face contort with surprise.
Have you found anything?
The halfling asked. Drizzt shook his head.
We are close, he replied quietly. Both Guinevere and I are certain of that.
Regis walked over and picked up his torch, then tucked his mace into his belt within easy reach. Guinevere's sudden growl echoed at them from farther down the long corridor, launching them both into a run.
Don't leave me behind, Regis demanded, and he grabbed hold of Drizzt's cloak and would not let go, his furry feet skipping, jumping, even skidding along as he tried to keep pace.
Drizzt slowed when Guinevere's yellow-green, glassy eyes reflected back at him from just beyond the leading edge of the torchlight, at a corner where the passageway turned sharply.
I think we found the dwarves,
Regis muttered grimly. He handed Drizzt the torch and let go of the cloak, following the drow up to the bend. Drizzt peeked around. Regis saw him wince, then brought the torch into the open, casting light on the dreadful scene. They had indeed found the missing dwarves, sliced and slaughtered, some lying, some propped against the walls at irregular intervals along a short expanse of worked stone corridor.
If you're not for wearing the apron, then don't ye be wearing it, Brunner said in frustration.
Caddy Breen nodded, finally hearing the concession she had wanted from the beginning.
But me king,
protested Cobble, the only other one in the private chamber with Brunner and Caddy Breen. Both he and Brunner sported severe holy water headaches.
Bah!
The dwarf king snorted to silence the good-intentioned cleric.
You're not knowing me, girl, as well as meself. If she's saying she won't be wearing it, then all the giants of the spine of the world couldn't be changing her mind. Bah yourself!
Came an unexpected call from outside the room, followed by a tremendous knock.
I know you're in there, Brunner Battlehammer, who calls himself King of Mithril Hall. Now be opening your door and meet your better. Do we know that voice?
Asked Cobble, he and Brunner exchanging confused glances.
Open it, says me,
came another cry, followed by a sharp rap. Wood splintered as a glove nail, a large spike set into the face of a specially constructed metal gauntlet, wedged itself through the thick door.
Ah, sandstone,
came a quieter call. Brunner and Cobble looked to each other in disbelief. No, they said in unison, wagging their heads back and forth.
What is it?
Caddy Breen asked, growing impatient.
It cannot be,
Cobble replied, and it seemed to the young woman that he hoped with all his heart that his words were true. A grunt signaled that the creature beyond the door had finally extracted his spike.
What is it?
Caddy Breen demanded of her father, her hands planted squarely on her hips. The door burst open, and there stood the most curious-looking dwarf Caddy Breen had ever seen.
He wore a spiked steel gauntlet, open-fingered on each hand, had similar spikes protruding from his elbows, knees, and the toes of his heavy boots, and wore armor, custom-fitted to his short, barrel-like form, of parallel, horizontal metal ridges, half an inch apart and ringing his body from neck to mid-thigh, and his arms from shoulder to forearm. His gray helmet was open-faced, with thick leather straps disappearing under his monstrous black beard, and sported a gleaming spike atop it, nearly half again as tall as the 4-foot dwarf.
"It," Brunner answered, his tone reflecting his obvious disdain, "is a battle rager."
"Not just a battle rager,"
the curious black-bearded dwarf put in.
"The battle rager! The most wild battle rager!"
He walked toward Catti Bree and smiled widely with his hand extended toward her. His armor, with every movement, issued grating, scraping noises that made the young woman's hair stand straight up on the back of her neck.
"Thibbledorf Puente at your service, me good lady,"
the dwarf introduced himself grandly.
"First fighter of Mithril Hall. Yourself must be this Catti Bree I've heard so much tell of back in Adbar. Brunner's human daughter, so they telled me. Though still, I'm a bit shaken at seeing any battlehammer woman without a beard to tickle her toes."
The smell of the creature nearly overwhelmed Catti Bree. Had he taken that armor off any time this century, she had to wonder. "I'll try to grow one," she promised.
"See that you do! See that you do!"
Thibbledorf hooted, and he hopped over to stand before Brunner, the noise of his armor scraping at the marrow of Catti Bree's bones.
"Me king!"
Thibbledorf bellowed. He fell to a bow, and nearly halved Brunner's long, pointy nose with his helmet spike as he did.
"What in the nine hells is yourself doing here?"
Brunner demanded.
"Alive, anyway,"
Cobble added. Then he returned Brunner's incredulous stare with a helpless shrug.
"It was me belief that you fell when the dragon Shimmergloom took the lower halls,"
Brunner went on.
"His breath was death,"
Thibbledorf shouted. "Look who's talking," Catti Bree thought, but she kept silent. Puente roared on, dramatically waving his arms about and turning a spin on the floor, his eyes staring at nothing in particular, as though he was recalling a scene from his distant past.
"Evil breath! A deep blackness that fell over me and stole the strength from me bones! But I got out and got away!"
Thibbledorf cried suddenly, spinning at Catti Bree, one stubby finger pointing her way.
"Out a secret door in the lower tunnels! Even the likes of that dragon couldn't stop the Puente! We held the halls for 2 more days before Shimmergloom's minions drove us into Keeper's Dale,"
Brunner put in.
"I heard no words of your return to fight beside me father and his father, the then king of Mithril Hall. It was a 10 day afore I got me strength back, and got back around the mountain passes to the western door,"
Puente explained.
"By then the halls were lost. Some time later,"
Puente continued, parting his impossibly thick beard with one of his glove nails,
"I heard that a bunch of the younger folk, yourself included, had gone to the west. Some said ye were to work the mines of Mirabar, but when I got there I heard not a word."
200 years,
Brunner growled in Puente's face, stealing his seemingly perpetual smile.
"Ye had 200 years to find us, but not once did we hear a word that ye was even alive." "I came back to the east,"
Puente explained easily.
"Been living. Living well, doing mercenary work mostly, in Sundabar and for King Harbrum of Citadel Adbar. It was back there, 3 10 days past. I'd been off to the south for some time,